Good evening. It's March 4th, 2016. We're in Gainesville, Florida at the Gainesville Retreat Center with Bhante Vimalaramsey. Tonight's Dhamma talk will be on Majjhima Nikaya number 43, the greater series of questions and answers.
Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living in Swati and Jetta's Grove, Anathan Bendika's Park. Then, when it was evening, the Venerable Mahakohita rose from meditation, went to the Venerable Sariputta, and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side and said to the Venerable Sariputta, now, Mahakohita was an arahat. And when he came and talked with Sariputta, he had a lot of students with him. And he was asking these questions so the students could understand what Sariputta was talking about. One who is unwise is said, with reference to what was this said, one who is unwise. Now, again, every time you hear the word wise or wisdom in the Buddhist text, it's talking about the links of dependent origination. One does not wisely understand. One does not wisely understand, friend. That's why it is said, one who is unwise. And what doesn't one wisely understand? One doesn't wisely understand this is suffering. One does not wisely understand this is the origin of suffering. One does not wisely understand this is the cessation of suffering. One does not wisely understand this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. One does not wisely understand. One does not wisely understand. That's why it said one who is unwise. Now, on the surface, it sounds like it's just, well, this is just the Four Noble Truths. It's not any big deal. But as I showed you before, the links of dependent origination are in each of the links of dependent origination. So when you say you don't understand wisely, it's talking about not being able to see how the links of dependent origination actually work and how each link is conditioned. Okay. And with that condition comes suffering. Nibbana is an unconditioned state. So we're talking about how to be able to recognize this so you can get to an unconditioned state. Saying, good friend, the Venerable Mahakohita delighted and rejoiced in the Venerable Sariputta's words. Then he asked him a further question. One who is wise is said, friend, with reference to what was this said, one who is wise. There's always been a question of how to look for a teacher. How did I get over here so far? Ah, there it is. And the Buddha gives you an answer. What to look for in a teacher? How do you find a teacher? He says, monks, one who does not know and see as it actually is, aging and death, its origin, cessation, and way leading to the cessation, should search for a teacher in order to know this as it really is. Monks, one who does not know and see as it really is, birth, habitual tendency, clinging, craving, feeling, contact, the six sense base, mentality, materiality, consciousness, and formations, their origin, cessation, and way leading to their cessation, should search for a teacher in order to know this as it is. So what he's saying is, look for somebody that deeply understands how this process works. And from the very beginning of this retreat, I've been showing you different ways of seeing dependent origination. So when you're looking for a teacher, this is what you need to look for. And look at the students that are being taught. Are they happy? Do they have a mind that's uplifted? Are they keeping their precepts without breaking them? These are things that really need to be observed in order to find a teacher that is going to help show you how this process works. Now, a lot of you are doing very well, and I'm real happy. And you're starting to grasp more how this process works. It's a lot different than going to a teacher and the teacher just says, well, just keep doing what you're doing, that's fine. So this is an important question of one who is unwise or one who is wise. Look for a teacher that is wise, that understands these links of dependent origination and the practical application of that. Now, in Burma, one of the real famous Burmese teachers is Mahasi Sayadaw. I was at Mahasi Center. It was after he died, unfortunately. But they were teaching the same way. And there was a lot of books that were being translated from Mahasi Sayadaw's talks. So I got this book that he wrote on dependent origination. And in the index, when you first start, it's not index, at the introduction. One of the first sentences it has in there is that this is extremely difficult to understand. The links of dependent origination, it takes a long time to understand this. And as I read his book, I had to agree with him because he tried to explain it in such a way that was extremely complicated. And I had no idea what he was talking about. But now you have a more practical way of looking at it and seeing that, yeah, when this feeling arises, there is craving, there is clinging, or there is clinging, there is habitual tendency, there is a birth of action, there is sorrow and lamentation. And as you're able to see this, you start using the six R's more and more, and these last links don't even arise anymore. And that leads to an uplifted mind, not only while you're on retreat, but you're carrying this with you. The six R's you can carry with you with your daily life. The trick is to remember it. And develop your sense of humor about yourself. You're not going to hear meditation teachers that are going to tell you that you're supposed to be happy. They're going to tell you you're supposed to suffer. I was staying at a Zen center, and people would come and they'd want to learn about meditation. And it was here in Gainesville. And this teacher that I was staying with, he would give them just meditate as instructions. And then after a half an hour, we would not meditate, and first thing he would say is, "All life is suffering." And I had trouble being around somebody that said that. And I said, you know, I'm really more interested in learning how to let go of that suffering. I don't need to indulge in the suffering. I've already got enough of that. How do you get out of this deep hole that you're in? As a result, I wound up not staying there very long. So, one who is wise, one who is wise is said, friend, with reference to what was this said, one who is wise. One wisely understands. All of you have developed your wisdom a lot on this retreat. You're understanding how your old ways of acting and your old ways of getting caught in dissatisfaction and dislike, how they cause your suffering and how they continually cause your suffering. I've been a monk for 30 years. I've had that many headaches in 30 years. Why? Because I start to see a headache arise, I start relaxing the tightness in my neck, and then I relax. It goes away. There are some physical things that can cause a headache, and that doesn't work very well. That's why I've had 5 headaches. But I never have that kind of problem. I don't make headaches for myself by disliking a feeling that comes up and try to control it with my thoughts. And I don't take things so personally. So if you want to truly change, you have to be able to use your six R's as much as possible. Carry them with you. Use them when you can remember. Because of the work you've done here, when you go home, you're going to get in some of the same kind of situations that you always did. But now your perspective is going to be a little different. Doesn't mean you won't get caught by an emotional thing occasionally, but it won't last for near as long. And you'll start to see, why do I want to cause myself suffering? Why am I doing this to myself? That's why you have to laugh. Because it changes your perspective. You go from, I'm mad and I don't like it, and when you laugh with yourself for how crazy mine can be, it changes to, well, it's only this anger. Do I want to carry this around with me for the rest of the day? No. Let it go. When the Buddha said in the Dhammapada, we are the happy ones, that's what he was talking about. You understand how mind works and you don't get so caught up in it. And everything becomes much easier. And all life starts to be more fun. One of the ways you know that you're starting to advance spiritually is you stop laughing at things and you start laughing with things. The two dogs were outside. One of them came running up, made me kind of laugh with myself. Oh, all right, I get to go pet a dog. I love dogs. Instead of, oh, I don't want this dog around, my mind doesn't go that way now. At one point it did. I didn't like dogs so much. But you start changing your perspective in the way you see life. And you stop causing yourself so much suffering. Because you can't blame anybody out here for your suffering. You are causing it for yourself. Somebody says something you don't like. I don't like that. I'm mad. Well, okay, you can do that or not. Somebody says something that's mean, you can forgive them right then. I forgive in your mind. I forgive you for doing that. I know you really don't mean it. Doesn't matter. You'll get more of that tomorrow night. One wisely understands, and that's what you're learning to do, is wisely understand. You can't make the outside world your enemy. It's not. You are your own worst enemy. With a mind that's overcritical, a mind that's hard, you can do 20 things in a day that are absolutely neat. Help other people, you help them smile, you help them be happy in one way or another. And you do one thing that your mind says, oh, I shouldn't have done that. What do you think about? The 20 things you did that was good, or that one thing that was questionable? And how much do you beat yourself up because of it? That's what the 6 hours are for. You have to have harmonious communication with number one before you can have harmonious communication with everybody else. So that's how you're starting to develop this habit of wisely understanding. What does one wisely understand? One wisely understands this is suffering. One wisely understands this is the cause of suffering. One wisely understands this is a cessation of suffering. Now, in this book, there's another sutta that says, There is a right way to teach and a wrong way to teach. The wrong way to teach, everything is suffering. The right way to teach, how to let go of that suffering. And to my way of thinking, there's too many people that are really focusing too much on suffering. So you have to forgive other people for not understanding. But that doesn't mean you don't understand. And when you are really starting to understand, you're starting to practice the cessation of suffering. You're letting go of emotional stuff. It's not yours anyway. Why do you take it personally? Well, he said this and it hurt my feelings. Whose feelings are hurt? Who doesn't like that? Who wants it to be different? Who's taking it personally and causing themselves suffering? I am. So you're starting to learn more and more clearly how the Buddha's teaching actually works and why to do it. Why to practice this way? This doesn't have anything to do with religion. They throw Buddhism into religion because they couldn't figure out what it really was. This is mental development. It's not religion. You don't have to believe anything that I say. As a matter of fact, I don't want you to believe anything that I say. Try it and see for yourself. Does your mind feel better when you do wholesome things? Well, do that over and over again. Okay. Consciousness. Consciousness is said, friend, with reference to what is consciousness said. It cognizes. It cognizes, friend. What does that mean, cognize? It means you see in the present. You see without the identification of this is me, this is mine. When you recognize, now you're going back into your old memories, but when you cognize, you're seeing it just as it is right now. This is why consciousness is said. What does it cognize? It cognizes this is pleasant. It cognizes this is painful. It cognizes this is neither painful nor pleasant. It cognizes, friend. That's why consciousness is said. Wisdom and consciousness, friend, are these states conjoined or disjoined? And is it possible to separate each of these states from the other in order to describe the difference between them? Interesting question. Wisdom and consciousness, friend, these states are conjoined, not disjoined. And it's impossible to separate each of these states from the other in order to describe the difference between them. For what one wisely understands, that one cognizes. And what one cognizes, that one wisely understands. That is why these states are conjoined, not disjoined. And it's impossible to separate each of these states from the other in order to describe the difference between them. What is the difference, friend, between wisdom and consciousness, these states that are conjoined, not disjoined? The difference, friend, between wisdom and consciousness, these states that are conjoined, not disjoined, This is, wisdom is to be developed and consciousness is to be fully understood. Nice. Wisdom is to be developed. When you finally start to settle down with your mind and your mind is more peaceful and calm and you start seeing how these things start arising and how you can use the 6 hours to let go of the suffering, let go of the craving. And your consciousness being able to cognize that is to be understood. This is what you're doing. Feeling. Feeling is said, friend, with reference to what is feeling said. It feels. It feels, friend. That's why feeling is said. Now, this doesn't have anything to do with emotional feelings. This just has to do with feeling. What's feeling? I've already told you what feeling is. Feeling is pleasant, painful, neither painful nor pleasant. That's all it is. What does it feel? It feels pleasure. It feels pain. It feels neither pain nor pleasure. It feels. It feels, friend. That's why feeling is said. Perception. Perception is said, friend, with reference to what is perception said. It perceives. It perceives. That is why perception is said. What does it perceive? Now, the perception is the part of the mind that names things. You look at this and you say, this is a cup. Why? Because perception has memory in it. And when it names things, you start to get into your conceptual thinking. Every thought you have is concept. What is a concept? Well, I'm sitting on a chair. What is a chair? Is it the legs? Is it the seat? Is it the back? Where is a chair? It's made up of different things put together to make this concept. Automobile. Where is an automobile? Is it the wheels? Is it the motor? Is it the steering wheel? Is it the bumper? Where is an automobile? Again, it's a lot of things put together to make up this concept. We only think in concepts. When you experience Nibbana, you go beyond concepts. There are no more concepts. Why? Because it's an unconditioned state. We don't have the condition of concepts arising when you experience Nibbana. So what this is going to get into is the concept of colors. It perceives blue, it perceives yellow, it perceives red, it perceives white. It perceives, friend. That's why perception is said. Feeling, perception, and consciousness, friend, are these states conjoined or disjoined? And is it possible to separate each of these states from the others in order to describe the difference between them? Feeling, perception, and consciousness, friend, these states are conjoined, not disjoined. And it's impossible to separate each of these states from the others in order to describe the difference between them. For what one feels, that one perceives. And what one perceives, that one cognizes. So, when you're talking about the five aggregates, you have feeling, well, you have body, but you have feeling, perception, formations, consciousness. Actually, these five aggregates are just three aggregates, because feeling, perception, and consciousness are conjoined. They're not separate things. That is why these states are conjoined, not disjoined, and it's impossible to separate each of these states from the others in order to describe the difference between them. Knowledge or knowable by mind alone. Friend, what can be known by purified mind consciousness? Released from the five faculties. Friend, by purified mind consciousness alone, released from the five faculties, the base of infinite space can be known thus. Space is infinite. The base of infinite consciousness can be known thus. Consciousness is infinite. The base of nothingness can be known. There is nothing. Now these are the immaterial realms. Did you hear me say anything about body in that? No, these are all mental realms. When a feeling arises, oh, I have this pain in my bottom. When you're in one of these realms, it's a mental feeling. It's not a physical feeling, because you don't have any body when you're in a mental realm. And this is one of the reasons that when that pain arises, it is a hindrance. But almost everybody says, well, I got to get up, I got this pain. No, that's a meditation pain, isn't it? Because it's mental. It's not physical. When you get up and start walking, that pain goes away really quickly. Why? Because you had restlessness in your mind. I don't like this feeling. I want it to stop. I want it to go away. And the truth is, it's all mental. So you 6R and allow that feeling to be there. But I 6R'd and it didn't go away. 6Rs aren't there to make things go away. 6Rs are there so you let go of the identification with it. Whose pain is it? It's just a pain. It's not yours. So this is when you need to develop your patience. Patience leads to Nibbana. Boy, I hated that when I was told. I was patient as long as it happened when I wanted it to happen. Friend, with what does one understand a state that can be known? Friend, one understates that can be known with the eye of wisdom, seeing the links of dependent origination. Now, every time you see dependent origination, you're seeing the true nature of everything. And you're seeing that everything is impersonal. That's like the biggest part of truly understanding how this process works. Because it's not me. It's not mine. I didn't ask this pain to come up. But something in my mind grabbed onto it and identified with that pain. I said, this is me, and I don't like it, and I'm going to do something about it. When you six are that, you're letting go. Now you're starting to see with the eye of wisdom, and you're starting to see that impersonal nature, and it's just a pain. So what? I don't like it. Oops. Friend, what is the purpose of wisdom? Good question. The purpose of wisdom, friend, is direct knowledge. See how it actually arises. Its purpose is full understanding. Its purpose is abandoning. Okay? Okay, now we're going to get to right view. Friend, how many conditions are there for the arising of right view? Friend, there are two conditions for the arising of right view. The voice of another and wise attention. What does it mean, the voice of another? It's not my voice. It's the Buddha's voice. He's the one that saw this. He's the one that showed us how this process actually works. It's his voice. There are two conditions for the arising of right view. Friend, how many factors is right view assisted when it has deliverance of mind for its fruit? Deliverance of mind for its fruit and fruition. When it has deliverance by wisdom for its fruit. And deliverance by wisdom for its fruit and fruition. Friend, right view is assisted by five factors. When it has deliverance of mind for its fruit, deliverance of mind for its fruit and fruition. When it has deliverance of wisdom for its fruit, and deliverance by wisdom for its fruit and fruition. The fruit is the path knowledge, magga. The fruition is pala. Here, friend, right view is assisted by virtue, keeping your precepts, learning, discussion, serenity, and insight. Right view is assisted by these five factors, and it has deliverance of mind for its path, and deliverance of mind for its path and fruition. It has deliverance by wisdom for its path, and deliverance by wisdom for its path and fruition. Now, this is kind of interesting that of these five things, two of them are insight, and collectedness of mind, and they are yoked together. If you have a bullock cart and one of the bulls is pulling harder than the other, you're not going to go in a straight line. Right? You're just going to go in a circle. Or if the other one is too strong and it's pulling too hard, then you go in a circle the other way. You need them to pull equally so you can go in a straight line. Friend, how many kinds of being are there? There are these three kinds of being, friend. Sense sphere being. That's the human realm. Fine material being. That's the Devaloka and Brahmalokas, the heavenly realms. And immaterial being. Now, what I'm showing all of you right now is how to get into the immaterial beings. Now, the Devalokas are heavenly realms and they're real nice, but you don't need to do any meditation to get into them. All you have to do is be a nice person. And they can last for quite a while, but it's not going to be a permanent thing. When you start meditation and you get into the first jhana, if you just do it one time, it's such a powerful experience that when you die, you're going to be born in a Brahmaloka. A Brahmaloka lasts for a long time. Now the Devaloka, let's say you go to the Tamsa teams of heaven. That's where Sakka is king. One day in the Tamsa teams of heaven is equivalent to 100 years in the human realm. And you live to be about 100 years. So it lasts for a long time. And when you go to some of the higher realms, like the Tusita heaven, where the Bodhisattva Maitreya is hanging out, one day there is equivalent to 400 years here. So my teacher died in 2005 or 6, I don't remember which. He's been there for, 3 minutes? To him. But when you start developing your mind, you get into the Brahmalokas. Now this sounds like it's a long time. The Devalokas. But when you get into the Brahmalokas, then you get into Asankhyas. And Asankhya is 10 with 160 zeros behind it. That's how many years it lasts in human terms. And when you get into the second and then the third, it starts lasting longer and longer. And when you get into the third, it will last 15 mahakapas. Mahakapas is a world cycle. And a world cycle really lasts for a long time. A mahakapa is 4 asankhyas. Okay? So you multiply 160 by 4. And that's 540, I think, years, or zeros. Now there's four Mahakalpas. One is the expansion of the universe, when the universe is going out. That's when life occurs on planets. And it will do that for one asankhya. And then it will stop for one asankhya. And then it will contract for one asankhya. And then it will stop for one asankhya. And then, big bang, starts all over again, expanding. So this happens for long periods of time. Now, I was talking about the immaterial realms, infinite space, infinite consciousness. When you die from this realm, if you don't attain Nibbana, you're going to be reborn in an immaterial realm. If you only get to infinite space, you're going to be in that immaterial realm for 20,000 Mahakalpas. If you get to infinite consciousness and you die, you're going to last for 40,000 Mahakalpas. If you get into the realm of nothingness and you never go any deeper, you're going to be reborn in the immaterial realm for 60,000 Mahakalpas. Now we're talking long periods of time, but it's not forever and ever. When your karma from getting into that realm exhausts itself, you'll be reborn in one of the lower Brahma lokas. You'll be there for however long, and then you're going to be reborn in a Deva loka, and you'll be there for whatever, however long, and then, depending on your karma, you're going to be reborn in the human realm or one of the lower realms, the hell realms, depending on your karma. It doesn't last forever. If you get into neither perception nor non-perception, that lasts for 84,000 Mahakalpas. And that's what people, they say, that's the best you can do. But the Buddha said, this is still being on the wheel of samsara. Eventually, you're going to come back down to a human realm, and then you have the same kind of problems you always have. But the Buddha wasn't satisfied with that. He wanted to find Nibbana. Nibbana is an interesting thing to talk about, but we only have concepts. We only think in concepts, and this is beyond concepts. It's unconditional. So what happens when you are an arahat and you die? It's like you build a sandcastle right by the beach, and it has all of these grains of sand in exactly the right spot for this sandcastle. And then a wave comes and knocks it all down. Now, the thing that holds us together on the wheel of samsara is craving. Arahats don't have any craving. So when they die, it's just like all of the things that made up that arahat are still there. but you can't put them together in the same way again. Okay? So it's not that you completely disappear. Well, you completely disappear, but all of the things that made you a human being are still around, but they're not held together with craving. In science right now, they're starting to prove that there is consciousness in space. And they're proving it. And it is reasonable. And they're saying that space has intelligence in it. And they're starting to prove that too. But the light went out, David.
There's nothing I can do about that.
Okay. So it's not nihilism. It's not just complete disappearing of everything. It just doesn't work that way. Okay. So this is getting into philosophy, and you can take it as real or not, I don't care. Doesn't matter. What matters is what you're doing right now. What are you doing with whatever arises? Now, you hear me insisting that you have to use the 6 R's and you got to use it more. Why? Because I'm getting you so that you can develop the habit of using 6 R's when something comes up into your mind. And when it happens automatically, you'll feel that relief. You'll feel it. Ah, this is good. Another interesting thing about Nibbana. There's two kinds of Nibbana. One is called the mundane Nibbana. Every time you use the 6 R's, you're practicing the mundane Nibbana. When you do that enough, and conditions are right, you will get to experience what they call the supra-mundane Nibbana. That's the other kind of Nibbana. This is the kind I was talking about. But every time you 6 R, every time you let go of craving, you are experiencing Nibbana. What does Nibbana mean? Ni means no. Bana means fire. Every time you use the 6 R's, you're putting out the fire. The fire of what? Craving. And taking things personally. You've heard me say over and over again that when you use the 6 R's, right after that, your mind is clear and pure. Because there's no craving in your mind at that time. So don't get caught up in the story of stuff. Don't get caught up in liking stuff too much. You have to 6 R. Let go of the identification of that. And that leads to definite happiness. Okay. Friend, how is the renewal of being in the future generated? Interesting question. Friend, renewal of being in the future is generated through the delighting in this and that on the part of beings who are hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. How important is it to let go of craving? You start to see the letting go of ignorance. You're not ignoring anymore how the process works. Friend, how is the renewal of being in the future not generated? Friend, with the fading away of ignorance, with the arising of true knowledge, with the cessation of craving, renewal of being in the future is not generated. Now we're going to get into the first jhana. Friend, what is the first jhana? Here, friend, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a person enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by thinking and examining thought with joy and happiness born of seclusion. This is called the first jhana. Friend, how many factors does the first jhana have? Friend, the first jhana has 5 factors. Here, when a person has entered upon the first jhana, there occur thinking, examining thought, joy, happiness, and unification of mind. That is how the first jhana has 5 factors. Friend, how many factors are abandoned in the first jhana, and how many factors are possessed? Friend, in the first jhana, 5 factors are abandoned and 5 factors are possessed. Here, when a monk has entered upon the first jhana, sensual desire is abandoned, ill will is abandoned, sloth and torpor are abandoned, restlessness and anxiety are abandoned, and doubt is abandoned. So when you're in the first jhana, you are purified, have a purified mind, and there's no hindrances. Stay on your object of meditation. And there occur thinking, examining thought, joy, happiness, and unification of mind. That is how the first jhana has 5 factors that are abandoned and 5 factors are possessed. Friend, these 5 faculties each have a separate field, a separate domain, and do not experience each other's field and domain. That is the eye faculty, ear faculty, nose faculty, tongue faculty, and body faculty. Now, not having the same field and the same domain, you don't taste through your ear. You taste through your tongue. So the field of tongue is how you're able to separate all of these things. And these 5 faculties, each having a separate field, a separate domain, not experiencing each other's field and domain, what is their resort? What experiences these fields of and domains? Friend, these 5 faculties each have a separate field, a separate domain, and do not experience each other's field and domain. That is the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body faculties. These five faculties each have a separate field and a separate domain, not experiencing each other's field and domain. They have mind as their resort. Mind experiences these fields and domains. Friend, as to these five faculties, that is the eye, ear, nose, tongue, and body faculty, what do these five faculties stand in dependence on? Friend, as to these five faculties, that is the eye, ear, nose, tongue, and body, these five faculties stand in dependence on vitality. Friend, what does vitality stand in dependence on? Vitality stands in dependence on heat. Friend, what does heat stand in dependence on? You're going to love this answer. Heat stands in dependence on vitality. Just now, friend, we understand the Venerable Sariputta to have said vitality stands in dependence on heat, and now we understand him to say heat stands in dependence on vitality. How should the meaning of this statement be regarded? Good question, huh? In that case, friend, I shall give you a simile. For some wise men here understand the meaning of a statement by means of a simile. Just as when an oil lamp is burning, its radiance is seen in dependence on flame, and its flame is seen in dependence on its radiance. Got it? They're conjoined. Can't have one without the other. Okay? So vitality stands independent on heat, and heat stands in dependence on vitality. Friend, are vital formations things that can be felt? Or are vital formations one thing, and things that can be felt another? Vital formations, friend, are not things that can be felt. If vital formations were things that can be felt, then a person who has emerged upon the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness would not be seen to emerge from it. Okay, when you get to the cessation of feeling, perception, and consciousness, it's just like that light. Turns out there is nothing. When the feeling, perception, and consciousness arises again, then you will have a vital formations, and that means the six sense doors. Because vital formations are one thing and things that can be felt another, a monk or a person who has entered upon the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness can be seen to emerge from it. Friend, when this body is bereft of how many states, is it then discarded and forsaken, left lying senseless like a log? Friend, when this body is bereft of three states, vitality, heat, and consciousness. It is then discarded and forsaken, left laying senseless like a log. Friend, what is the difference between one who is dead, who has completed his time, and a person who has entered upon the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness? Friend, in the case of one who is dead, who has completed his time, his bodily formations have ceased and subsided. His verbal formations have ceased and subsided. His mental formations have ceased and subsided. His vitality is exhausted. His heat has been dissipated, and his faculties are fully broken up. In the case of a person who has entered upon the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness, his bodily formations have ceased and subsided. His verbal formations have ceased and subsided. His mental formations have ceased and subsided, but his vitality is not exhausted. His heat has not been dissipated, and his faculties become exceptionally clear and bright. And when somebody is sitting in a cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness, when they come out, their face is glowing really good. And it goes out for a ways. It's like a halo. And you can see this. I mean, you really do see it. And on one of the retreats that I gave in Indonesia, there were three people on that retreat that had that experience and became an anagami. So they were learning how to sit in the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. One lady sat for 9 hours. One man sat for 15 hours. And I told him, you can sit up to 7 days. When you come out, your mind is so amazingly pure that you're just radiant. When the three of them did it at one time, and then they broke because they wanted to listen to a Dhamma talk, it was like I had spotlights in the room. And it was great. And you could see, I'm sitting here looking at people, and there's these glows coming off of them. Because they have had such a pure mind, it's a real good idea to give something to them and get the merit back for doing that. It will come back a lot of times in positive ways for that. And unfortunately, I haven't had one of my students become an arahat yet, because they can do the same thing. You want to be an arahat? I'm married.
I became Mrs. O'Brien instead. Monty, are you going to discuss, I think, the four stages?
Yeah. I'm coming to it. Be patient.
You can't. How did you marry?
To be an arahat, you need to take the robes on. You need the purity of the sangha. So, you can be an anagami and be married, but you will live like brother and sister. You're not going to be interested in any kind of sexual activity at all. In another sutta, there's a man that became an anagami, and his wife started rejoicing that he did so well and asked him if she could become a nun. And he said, yes, of course you can become a nun. And she went to a monastery, and 3 months later she'd become an arahat. What a family. And they got together and had discussions, and they were great Dhamma discussions. Really good. Real interesting. And if we had more days on the retreat, if we could do that, I would also give you that sutta. Now, when you have an experience of cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness, when you come out of that state, you will feel a very strong relief. And one of the things it says in the Samyutta Nikaya, and you have become what is called a sotapanna in Pali. It's a stream enterer. And when you come out of that state, you feel this relief. And in the sutta, it says that you have given up an ocean of suffering. It's not some small thing. When you become a sotapanna, you never have any doubt as to what is the correct way to attain nibbana. Doubt will not arise again. You lose the belief that rites and rituals lead to nibbana. And you start seeing the truth that everything is impersonal. When you become a sotapanna, your mind, it becomes pure. You will not break a precept on purpose. If you try, your mind will say no. And when that happens, I'm going to say, okay, everything is good. Go back and sit. But the joy is real strong. Sometimes it's hard for people to sit. The joy lasts with you. You're going to feel the joy. And you'll get so used to it that you'll kind of forget that it's there. But you'll feel that there's a different perspective in your mind. Now you're seeing things more clearly. You're starting to recognize the links of dependent origination a little bit more clearly. If your mindfulness is very good, right after that relief, you'll see real quick some little bumps. And those are actually the links of dependent origination. And then the joy comes. The advantage of having this experience is you are getting younger every day. The most lifetimes that you will experience is 7. And, of course, I'm going to tell you, you need to sit more. Go back and sit. You get into the equanimity just for a shorter period of time and do the six directions and all directions, and then you'll get into neither perception nor non-perception, and you'll be able to sit for longer periods of time without having any disturbance, no movement of mind's attention at all. It's actually quite nice. And I have one student that could get into that state very easily. And she would sit for an hour without any disturbance in her mind at all. And then she had the thought, well, nothing is happening, so I'm just going to get up and start doing stuff. Drove me crazy. It took me 3 years to convince her that that was the wrong thing to do. 3 years. And when she finally got the idea that I wanted her to sit longer in that state, she became a sotapanna very quickly. But now when you become a sotapanna, you're going to be able to sit in this state for longer periods of time. And then when conditions are right, you're going to have the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. When you come out of that, it's going to be even more clear, the relief. The little links will become a little bit more clear, and the joy will be even a little bit stronger. And that is called the fruition of sotapanna. And of course you tell me that and I get all happy with you and okay, great, now go sit. So you do the same thing again. The problem is when you have that experience the first time and you start to get close to it again, you jump at it. I want it. What makes it go away? That's why I keep telling you, you have to tell yourself, I don't care what happens next. It doesn't matter what happens next. My job is just to observe. And six are whenever necessary. And when they're able to do that, then they can be successful and get into the fruition. And then I tell you to go back and sit, and you do that, you get into neither perception nor non-perception, you sit for long periods of time, hour and a half, sometimes even 2 hours without a disturbance. There's a lot of relief in that. Now, this can happen. It's not everybody that has exactly the same experience of sitting long without having any disturbance. But eventually you will get to experience the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness again. When you come out, the relief is huge. And you will see more of these little links. You'll see it go through twice. And then the joy will arise again. When you get to this state, this is called a once-returner. The most you will be reborn in the human state is one more time. From there, you will attain arahatship and get off the wheel of samsara. But of course, I'm going to tell you to keep going. And as you do that, eventually conditions are right and you have the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness again. And this is the fruition. What the fruition does is it makes you like set in concrete. You're really set. And what happens is lust and hatred become much less. They still have some, but you catch it more quickly. So you continue on, and you have the cessation happen again. And when you come out again, that big relief, but you'll be able to see the links of dependent origination more clearly, and you'll see them three times. So it really gets set in you, and you really do see it. And of course, you have a lot more joy. Now, this is called a non-returner. You're not going to be reborn in the human state ever again. You will be reborn in a special kind of Brahmaloka that lasts for huge long periods of time. From there, you will become an arahat, get off the wheel of samsara. And of course, I'm going to tell you to keep going. And if you're conditions are right, you have this experience again, the cessation. Oh, when you're in anagami, you can make determinations to get into the cessation, and you make a determination. I've got a weekend off. Nobody's going to bother me. I think I'll sit for 2 days, and you can. When you get up, it's just like a flower opening up. You don't have any soreness. You don't have any stiffness. You just get up. And it feels to you like you've been sitting for 15, 20 minutes. But you can sit for 2 days. You don't get up to go to the bathroom. You don't need to. You don't need to eat. You don't need to drink. When you come out, your face is... Nobody can see their own radiance. That's one of the weird things. You go in front of a mirror and you say, well, everybody tells me my face is really bright. And you look at your face and it's like, you always see it. You know, it's just like looking in a mirror. So you might be smiling, but that's nothing new, because you see yourself smiling. But when you get to, and you get the fruition of anagami, and when that happens, you really see the links of dependent origination slowly and very easily. And you'll see them come up, and you'll see them cease, and you'll see that happen again and again. But your mind has become so peaceful and calm that you'll see these very, very clearly. And, of course, you got to go back and start over again. And when you get to be an arahat, this is your last lifetime. And what will come up into your mind is what had to be done has been done. There is no more becoming. That will come up into your mind. When you become an arahat, you let go of the 5 other fetters. You let go, and you never again have sloth and torpor. You never again have any restlessness arise in your mind. You let go of wanting to be reborn in some kind of Brahmaloka, other realm. You let go of pride. Even anagamis, they start thinking they're pretty hot stuff. They still have a little bit of attachment there. And you let go of ignorance. Now, what's the advantage of being around an arahat? They don't have any craving. They don't have any ignorance. Whatever question you ask them, they will give you exactly how it works. So some of my students, they're working to become arahats. I told them as soon as they become an arahat, I'm going to be their student. When they die from that realm, it's like the sandcastle. There is no more becoming. So that's what the Buddha was mostly interested in, is showing people how to do this. And you're on that path right now. And it leads to more and more happiness, more contentment. I mean, wouldn't it be nice to walk around with only equanimity in your mind? With only loving kindness in your mind? With only a collected mind that's always composed? There's nothing that can happen to them that would shake that. That's worth it, I think. And an anagami or an arahat, they can sit in the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness for 7 days. That's the longest they can sit in the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. If they sit longer, they will lose their heat and vitality, and body will die. Where are we here? Okay, we're going to get it more into the deliverance of mind. Friend, there are four conditions for the attainment of neither painful nor pleasant deliverance of mind. Here, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, a monk enters upon and abides in the fourth jhana, which has neither painful nor pleasure, and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. These are the four conditions for the attainment of neither painful nor pleasant deliverance of mind. Friend, how many conditions are there for the attainment of the signless deliverance of mind? Signless deliverance of mind means cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. Friend, there are two conditions for the attainment of the signless deliverance of mind. Non-attention to all signs. That's when your mind gets very peaceful and quiet. And the attention to the signless element. I have real problem with that translation, because what does that mean? Attention to signless? No, you're not attending to it. You don't have consciousness arising. How can you attend to it? You don't know you're in that state till you get out. So I have to look up the Pali on this one and see what it says. These are the two conditions for the attainment of the signless deliverance of mind. How many conditions are there for the persistence of the signless deliverance of mind? There are three conditions for the persistence of the signless deliverance of mind. Not attention to all signs, attention to the signless element, and the prior determination of its duration. So you have to make a determination. When we first started the retreat, I told you there was two things I wanted you to do before you went to sleep. Make a determination what time you're going to wake up, and to make a determination when you wake up to be smiling and happy. Okay? What I'm actually doing is getting you more accustomed to making determinations. And when you get to a certain place in your meditation, I'll ask you if you want to develop mastery into going in and out of the jhanas. And that's where you start using determinations more. Okay, the way you start to do this, I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but I tell you to sit in the first jhana for 14 minutes and 31 seconds. And you try, and you're going to probably miss, and that's okay. But then you go back in and you do it. Okay, I'm going to try to sit this time for 15 minutes and 4 seconds. And you probably miss, but as you get more used to doing it, you'll get closer and closer to the time until you can hit it every time that you try by making a determination. When you can do it then I tell you to do it for 29 minutes and 54 seconds. And you're still in the first jhana. That means going into the jhana, being in there for 29 minutes and 54 seconds and come out exactly at that time. When you can hit that every time, then I tell you, okay, now I want you to sit for 59 minutes and 3 seconds, or 60 minutes and 5 seconds, whatever it happens to be. When you come out after that hour's sitting, then I want you to make a short determination of going in and out of the first jhana in 7 seconds. In 9 seconds, in 4 seconds. When you can do that with every one of the jhanas and bases, then we start to have fun with it. And you make a determination, I'm going to go to the first jhana with loving kindness for this length of time. When I get out of that, then I want to go to the fourth jhana with compassion, because you'll be able to and skilled enough to go into all of the Brahma Viharas, even in the lower jhanas. And then you make a determination that I want to go to equanimity in the seventh jhana, or the third arupa jhana. And when you can do that with all of the jhanas and all of the different bases, then you're considered a master. And what's the advantage of that? You can go in and out of any of these jhanas in the blink of an eye. Now, I've read that the Buddha, when he was giving a Dhamma talk, would go in and out of a jhana between each word he said. Now, that's true mastery. But it gets real interesting when you get into mastery and you get in a situation where there's some real excitement happening and you think, okay, now we're going to get into the third jhana and radiate the third jhana and everybody's going to calm down. And you'll see that happen. And then they start having more balance in their mind, and then they start taking care of business that needs to be taken care of. So it's a real advantage to be able to go in and out of the jhanas with your determination. And that determination, of course, is good enough to do with the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. This can be an incredibly fun learning experience. Oh, how many conditions? There's two. How many conditions? There's three. Okay. How many conditions are there for the emergence from the signless deliverance of mind? Friend, there are two conditions for the emergence of the signless deliverance of mind: attention to signs and non-attention to the signless deliverance of mind. Friend, the immeasurable deliverance of mind. Now, the immeasurable deliverance of mind is talking about the Brahma-viharas, which is what I'm teaching you. The deliverance of mind through nothingness. The deliverance of mind through voidness. The deliverance and the signless deliverance of mind. Are these states different in meaning and different in name? Or are they one in meaning and different in name only? Friend, the immeasurable deliverance of mind, the deliverance of mind through nothingness, the deliverance of mind through voidness, the signless deliverance of mind. There is a way in which these states are different in meaning and different in name. And there is a way in which they are one in meaning and different in name only. What, friend, is the way in which these states are different in meaning and different in name? Here a monk abides pervading one quarter of the mind imbued with loving kindness. Does this sound familiar? Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above, below, around, and everywhere. Does that sound familiar? Huh? Sounds like the six directions to me. Does it to you? Oh, I didn't make it up. He abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. He abides pervading one quarter of a mind with compassion, and it goes through this whole thing again. And then he abides pervading one quarter of his mind imbued with joy. And then he abides pervading one quarter of his mind imbued with equanimity, likewise the second, the third, and the fourth. So above, below, around, and everywhere, and to all as to himself. He abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. This is called the immeasurable deliverance of mind. Isn't that a coincidence? That's what I'm showing you. And going beyond that. And what, friend, is a deliverance of mind through nothingness? Here, with the complete surmounting of the base of infinite consciousness, aware that there is nothing. Now, what it's talking about is mind does not look outside of itself anymore. And so there's no six sense doors at the time. There's only one sense door, that's mind. Staying with your equanimity. And there can be some real interesting things that happen in this. When you get into nothingness, you start and equanimity. If you put too much effort, too much energy into staying with the equanimity, your mind is going to start get a little restless. If you don't give it quite enough energy, quite enough effort, your mind is going to get a little dull. So this is where you get to learn how to balance your energy. Little bits at a time. Oh, I'm trying a little bit too hard. I have to back off a little bit here. And then your mind will just, okay. Or, my mind's starting to get a little bit dull. Maybe I ought to pay more attention to my object of meditation. This is called the deliverance of mind through nothingness. And what, friend, is a deliverance of mind through voidness? Here a monk gone to the forest, gone to the root of a tree, to an empty hut, reflects thus, this is void of self, or what belongs to a self. This is called the deliverance of mind through voidness. I did about a 6-month practice. That's one of the advantages of being taking the robes on. I can take my time and just focus on things. And the practice was every time a thought arose, every time someone talked to me, every time there's sensation or feeling, is this me? Is this mine? Where am I? And I did that for 6 months. And you can get into the realm of nothingness by doing this. Somebody asked me why I didn't go further with it. I didn't think to, because that's all it says here. I didn't try. But to do that all the time with your daily activities, is this feeling mine? Is this thought mine? Is this opinion mine? Whose is that? Where did that come from? It's a real interesting practice. And you lose a lot of your false belief in a personal self when you start doing that. It's not mine. I didn't ask this stuff to happen. Interesting. Okay, let's go along and do something else. Kick a rock. That feeling mine? No. Okay. And there's thoughts about it, and there's other sensations that arise. Is that me? And that was right before, or right after, I'd gone and done the autopsies looking for where I was in the body. So that just kind of spurred me on to go deeper into it. It was an interesting practice for about 6 months. Okay. This is called deliverance of mind through voidness. And what is the signless deliverance of mind? Here, with non-attention to all signs, a person enters upon and abides in the signless collectedness of mind. That means the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. This is called the signless deliverance of mind. This is the way in which these states are different in meaning and different in name. And what, friend, is the way in which these states are one in meaning and different in name only? Lust is a maker of measurement. Hate is a maker of measurement. Delusion is a maker of measurement. A person whose taints are destroyed, these are abandoned, cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, done away with, so they're no longer subject to future arising. So what did I just say? Lust, hatred, delusion. What are we talking about? Letting go of craving. Of all the immeasurable deliverances of mind, the unshakable deliverance of mind is pronounced the best. Now, that unshakable deliverance of mind is void of lust, void of hate, and void of delusion. The unshakable mind means you have no craving. Lust is a something. Hate is a something. Delusion is a something. In a person whose taints are destroyed, these are abandoned, cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, done away with so that they're no longer subject to future arising. Of all the kinds of deliverance of mind through nothingness, the deliverance of mind is pronounced the best. The unshakable deliverance of mind is pronounced the best. Now, that unshakable deliverance of mind is void of lust, void of hate, and void of delusion. Lust is a maker of signs. Hate is a maker of signs. Delusion is a maker of signs. In a person whose taints are destroyed, these are abandoned, cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, done away with so that they're no longer subject to future arising. Of all these kinds of signless deliverance of mind, the unshakable deliverance of mind is pronounced the best. Now, that unshakable deliverance of mind is void of lust, void of hate, and void of delusion. In this way, or this is the way in which these states are one in meaning and different in name only. So all of these different kinds of meditation, when you use the six R's, you're getting closer and closer to having an unshakable mind. That is what the Venerable Sariputta said. The Venerable Mahakohita and all of his students were satisfied and delighted in the Venerable Sariputta's words. So, interesting questions and answers. I wish there was more of them in here. Do you have any questions that I can answer? Now, you've been listening to a Dhamma talk every night. Are you starting to see how everything kind of wovens together and how it all really ties together. Another word for, or another definition for sutta is thread. Okay? And when you start putting these threads together, you start making a magnificent rug. A Dhamma rug. And it starts affecting you in a positive way because it is letting go of craving. It's really important that you stay on your object of meditation. Don't let your mind get caught up in thinking this or that. Don't try to figure anything out by thinking about it. Just stay on your object of meditation. 6R, when your mind gets distracted by any kind of thought, any kind of feeling, any kind of sensation, it doesn't matter whether you hear a sound or not. When you get to a certain place in your meditation and you can sit very quietly without having disturbance, when you first notice that there is the start of a sound, if you can 6R right then, that sound will just go right through you. You won't even pay attention to it. But anything that disturbs you, anything that makes your mind move, you have to relax right then. You have to let go of the craving. Craving is amazingly persistent. It's going to keep coming up over and over again with every kind of disturbance that takes your mind away from your object of meditation. So you need to use your 6Rs and relax into it. Okay? Any question? You mean my Dhamma talk was so clear that you don't have any question at all? Yeah. Your mind is pure when you're on your object of meditation. When your mindfulness gets weak, that's when the hindrances come up, but you're not in the jhana anymore. And that's with every jhana.
So, speaking about the five aggregates, when he gives that description, of all the things that were present, he's just saying they were present, but when he was in the jhana, they
he wasn't paying attention to it. He was staying on his object of meditation. As you go deeper and deeper, you start seeing that more clearly. It's just the five aggregates and the four foundations of mindfulness are the same thing. I get a kick out of, or I used to get a kick out of being around monks and they say, well, I'm just taking one of the foundations of mindfulness and doing that. How can you do that? How can you take one foundation? You're just going to watch mine? That mean you're never going to have feeling arise? You're not going to be getting into any jhana. And what are you doing with your hindrances? Well, I'm just taking mind as my object of meditation. Does that mean there's no feeling? And you have to have a body. And you have the dhammas, the mind objects. They're still going to be there. How can you just take one? If you take one, you got to take them all. It's part of the package. Okay.
Yeah, at what level do you, when there's a cessation of feeling, perception, and consciousness?
It can happen at any jhana. It doesn't have to go all the way up to neither perception or non-perception. You can, when I was in Sri Lanka, there was a man that just barely got into compassion with infinite space. And he had a cessation happen right then. He came running to me, he was so excited, and I didn't have a translator at the time, so I couldn't tell him what happened. He had to wait for a little while before I could get a translator in. But it can happen in any jhana, when the conditions are right, when your understanding is good.
And it's a temporary situation. You can go back to it again.
Well,
and come out and go back.
You only experience the cessation for a short period of time. But it's such a strong experience. And you have that relief of letting go of immeasurable amounts of suffering. You know something special has happened. And then I have students that have that experience of the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. And I start talking to them about the relief and the joy and the change that happens in their mind. And they go, "Is that all? That's what I've been working for? There's got to be more than this." They're expecting some kind of fireworks to go off and all of it, but it's really a major thing that's happened for you. It's not any small potatoes. This is really, really a big thing. How many lifetimes have you lived without experiencing anything even close to this?
Shifting of your object of meditation?
It shifts by itself.
So there's no, in terms of people's stages, there's no intention or anything, it just...
It does it when conditions are right. When you get off retreat, I'll talk a little bit about this. When you get off retreat, your meditation's not going to be as good as it is now. Because you're going to be more active, you're not meditating as much. So, if, let's say, you've gotten to the realm of nothingness, okay, when you get off retreat, you're not going to be able to experience that so much. So what you do is go back to sending loving and kind thoughts to all beings in all directions. You do the six directions, you just go back to loving kindness. Your mind will, depending how much you sit, will start to progress again and go through all of the different stages until you get to the nothingness. And there's the question that always comes up. Okay, I'm going to get off retreat. How much do I have to sit? And you shouldn't ask me those kind of questions. Because I'm going to tell you 6 hours at least. If you sit for 1 hour a day, it's going to take a long time to get back to where you are right here, right now. If you can sit for 2 hours a day, it's twice as fast. It's going to happen faster. But it will go. You'll go through compassion and joy, and then into the nothingness, or even further. People that have had the experience of Nibbana, they don't really generally, they might start with loving kindness, but it might only last for 5 or 10 minutes, and then their mind just jumps over to equanimity. So it's kind of a personal thing. What happens? I'm putting a crack in your cosmic egg. Okay, I'm putting a crack so you know all of these different states by your experience. When you get home, it's time for you to go to work, get out of the egg. So, how much do you want to do that? How important is this to you? So don't ask me how long you should sit, because I want to see you keep progressing. I really do. And I'm also enough of a realist to know that if you have a job and you have to take care of the family and all of this kind of stuff, you're not going to have 6 hours. But I do recommend highly that you sit in the morning. Get up in the morning, do your morning things, wake up all the way, then sit. How long can you sit? That's your problem, not mine. If you can sit for 2 hours in the morning before you go to work, I think you ought to do it. You'll see the advantage of doing it. And I have some students that the only time they sit is when they're in retreat. And then they wonder, why isn't my progress faster? Well, what are you doing with your life? Well, I haven't been sitting very much. Okay. That's yours. I can't do anything about that. But I have had students that they had kids that got up at 6 o'clock in the morning because they had to be at school at 6:30, and they got up at 4 to sit in meditation for 2 hours before they started interacting with their children. And then they would go to work. So it's up to you. This stuff can happen to you at any time. One lady, she became a Sotapanna. Kept doing her meditation and her daily life. She was washing her dishes, and she felt her mind just starting to go zzz. So she went and sat on the couch, had a cessation experience right there. Can happen at any time. Doesn't have to be in a retreat. It happens more easily in a retreat because this is all you're doing. Now, be careful of your planning mind. When I get off retreat, I'm going to go see this person and talk to them and do this, and I'm going to go do that. That's restlessness. And you can sit there and plan all you want, what you're going to say, what they're going to say, and it doesn't even come close. So it's a waste of time. Tell your mind, I'll think about it later. I don't need to plan this stuff right now. I know what I'm going to do when I get off retreat. I'm going to clean up, pack the clothes, go home. Okay, you don't need to plan any more than that. Then you can plan more as time goes by. But you don't need to plan and then plan and then plan, and then plan. Just plan one time. You know what you're going to do for the day. You don't have to think about it over and over and over and over and over again. That's restlessness. You need to 6R that. If you need to write down what you need to do for the day, then write it down. No problem. But let go of thinking and rethinking and causing yourself suffering. Okay?
Is benefit lost if you have two sittings that are separate, like one in the morning and one in the evening?
Well, no, but it's better to do it all at one time. Because then you're starting to sit longer now, and you're starting to see the advantage of sitting longer. When you break it up, that means you're going to go back to where you were in the morning and have basically the same thing. There will be some advantage. But if you wait until the evening, you get home from work, you have to deal with whoever's at home, and you get tired and you say, or somebody comes and they say, hey, let's go out to dinner. Or let's go do this, or let's go do that. And you tell yourself, I'll meditate tomorrow. I'm going to go do this now. And what happens if you do that a couple of days, you forget about meditation altogether. So if you do it in the morning, it's a great way to start the morning. Sending loving kindness to everybody around you. Hey, yeah. Keep it going when you walk to the car. When you walk from the car into your job or house or whatever it happens to be, radiate loving kindness to all beings. Smile. Now you're practicing the Eightfold Path. Okay? Share some merit then. May suffering ones be suffering free, and the fear struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief, and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we thus acquire for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth, devas and nagas of mighty powers, share this merit of ours. May they long protect the Buddhist dispensation. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.